lot of friends who are friends of prolific author Neil Gaiman. That's right. I am a friend of a friend of a famous person. Seeing as this is Southern California, this statement probably doesn't mean much to most of you. Heck, we are all friends of famous people out here. But the reason I bring this up is that by mentioning that I was doing a sermon on the theology of Neil Gaiman was made significantly more difficult thanks to my well-meaning friends. One person said, interesting, in a way that seemed to imply that she thought I was making too much of the man. Another friend implied that Gaiman's theology was too whimsical to warrant a whole entire sermon. But let's face it, I don't have personal access to the author. Like the vast majority of his readers, my knowledge of the workings of Gaiman's mind is relegated to an analysis of his public artifacts, things like his books, his interviews, his website, and his blog. And the title, "The Theology Presented in the Books of Some Dude Whose Stuff I've Read," doesn't flow trippingly off the tongue, does it? So, we shall have to be content with the fact that I am actually looking at Neil Gaiman's theologies as established in his public works. I am not pretending to have deep, intimate knowledge of his mind or how it functions. Let me introduce you to Neil Gaiman, the writer. Neil Gaiman is quite the prolific author, writing in such genres as horror, fantasy, and mystery, and in such mediums as the novel, the short story, and the book-length comic book, also known as the graphic novel. The author of such works as American Gods, Neverwhere, The Graveyard Book, Coraline, and the award-winning graphic novel series, The Sandman, Gaiman has informed and influenced my theological thinking greatly. His trademark writing style is laced with dry wit and an encyclopedic knowledge of mythology, religion, and folklore. His work has the capacity to make the reader laugh and gasp with recognition simultaneously. He is, in my book, a sage of sorts. I was first introduced to the writing of Neil Gaiman when I discovered the book he co-wrote with fantasy author Terry Pratchett. The book was called Good Omens, The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch. I found the book at the college bookstore, on sale. Apparently, accurate prophecies don't sell well, a phenomenon pointed out in the book itself. The following paragraph grabbed my attention. God moves in extremely mysterious, not to say circuitous, ways. God does not play dice with the universe. He plays an ineffable game of his own devising, which might be compared, from the perspective of any of the other players, i.e., everyone, to being involved in an obscure and complex version of poker in a pitch dark room with blank cards for infinite stakes with a dealer who won't tell you the rules and who smiles all the time. An angel and demon fighting together to save Earth from the Antichrist and Armageddon because neither heaven nor hell have good restaurants? The four horsemen of the apocalypse riding motorcycles? A text that made hilarious use of footnotes? I was sold. While Good Omens is a fun read, I found myself intrigued by the theology presented therein. The main theme throughout the book is the issue of the ineffability of the divine. Ineffability has to do with ideas that are inherently too great to be expressed or comprehended. The book begins with our two protagonists, the angel Aziraphale and the demon Crowley, watching Adam and Eve depart the Garden of Eden, having tasted of the apple. Crowley doesn't see what's so bad about Adam and Eve knowing the difference between good and evil. It must be bad, reasoned Aziraphale in the slightly concerned tones of one who can't see it either and is worrying about it. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been involved. Crowley points out that putting the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden, pointing it out and saying, don't touch, wasn't exactly subtle. Makes you wonder what he's really planning. Best not to speculate, really, says Aziraphale. You can't second-guess ineffability, I always say. This is the beginning of the demon and angel's unlikely friendship. Being on Earth together for millennia, they discover that they have more in common with each other than they do with their counterparts in hell and heaven. They even perform miracles and temptations for each other and agree to let each other have free rein in their otherworldly shenanigans. Thus, Crowley designs Glasgow without interference, and Aziraphale, the angel, is free to design Edinburgh. Let that sink in a little bit. Throughout the book, the issue of ineffability continually comes up. Neither Crowley nor Aziraphale can tell if their friendship is part of the ineffable plan or against it. It is ineffable, after all. So they continue on until the Antichrist, who is christened Adam, is born. Then all heaven and hell break loose. Crowley and Aziraphale are supposed to be the representatives of hell and heaven on Earth, and they do work for their sides, but they like Earth and its inhabitants. They don't want to see it destroyed in the apocalypse, for you see, heaven and hell care nothing about the fate of the Earth in the apocalypse, only about which side wins in the ultimate battle. They see the apocalypse and Adam's role in it as part of the great plan. But heaven and hell never counted on Adam, the Antichrist, being raised as a normal boy rather than as the Antichrist, and his wanting nothing to do with the great plan. Adam says, I just don't see why everyone and everything has to be burned up and everything, just to see who's got the best gang. But even if you win, you just can't really beat the other side, because you don't really want to. I mean, not for good, you'll just start all over again. And then there's Crowley and Aziraphale. If they've learned anything during their time on Earth, it's that humans themselves possess the capacity for truly heart-stopping evil, as well as the capacity to show more grace than heaven ever dreamed of, all because of free will. Humans need very little pushing in either direction. Yet, according to Aziraphale, angels and demons are inherently set in their ways from the start and are either good or evil. But Aziraphale and Crowley go against their basic natures to try to save humanity. Does this mean that angels and demons have free will? Well, according to Crowley, you couldn't hang around humans for very long without learning a thing or two. So, heaven and hell are quite surprised when Aziraphale asks whether the great plan, which speaks of the apocalypse, is the same as the ineffable plan. And heaven and hell are flustered when they realize that they simply don't know. They therefore don't know whether the apocalypse being thwarted by an 11-year-old Antichrist and two beings of angel stock is or isn't part of the ineffable plan, because it's, you know, ineffable. Perhaps God actually isn't playing poker, after all. Perhaps God is actually playing solitaire. Around the same time that I read Good Omens, I discovered the comic book series The Sandman. The Sandman tells the story of Dream, the anthropomorphic embodiment of dreams and nightmares, the ruler of the realm of sleep. Dream and his siblings, Death, Desire, Despair, Delirium, Destiny, and Destruction, are not of our world, yet they control the fate of the mortals of our realm. The Sandman is a series of stories that, when read together, tell the much larger tale of the part that dreams and stories have on the human consciousness. During my first year of college, I would often hang out at the co-ed fraternity that would later become my home. We would gather in one member's bedroom and watch TV shows such as Star Trek: The Next Generation. I have therefore dated myself. It was on one such occasion that I found a comic book sitting on the member's bed. Curious, I started to read it. I was not new to comic books. I had been an avid comic book reader in my youth. However, by the time I reached middle school, I had given them up for other reading material that I felt was more mature. So imagine my surprise when I read this issue of The Sandman, wherein the character Death, a cute, perky, pale girl dressed in athletic gear, is busy trying to round up dead souls who are instead roaming the earth freely. Apparently, Lucifer Morningstar has given up the key to hell and abdicated, letting all condemned souls free to roam the earth. I was hooked. I needed to read more. I borrowed bound books of past issues of Sandman from friends and started at the beginning. I was amazed at how Gaiman took concepts of mythology, superheroes, horror, fantasy, and religion and wove them into a cohesive universe where dream and death wager on whether a man will ever want to give up his immortality and die, where entities more powerful than gods learn that no good can come from falling in love with a mortal human, where even Dream himself cannot escape fate. That particular issue of Sandman was part of a larger story arc called Season of Mists. In Season of Mists, Dream, known in this incarnation as Morpheus, travels to hell to free his former lover, Nada, an African queen whom he condemned to hell centuries ago for displeasing him. Upon his arrival in hell, he discovers that Lucifer has opened up the gates to hell and freed all, including the demons, who resided there. His reason for doing so, he has grown weary of doing a task which he sees as not actually necessary. In Lucifer's mind, hell is not other people. Rather, hell is peopled by those who insist that they must be condemned to suffer and be damned. 10 billion years spent providing a place for dead mortals to torture themselves. And like all the masochists, they call the shots. Burn me, freeze me, eat me, hurt me, and we did. The torture of hell exists because mortals expect it to. They blame Lucifer for forcing them to commit acts they would otherwise be repulsed by. The devil made me do it. I have never made one of them do anything. Never. They live their own tiny lives. I do not live their lives for them. The place of hell is just psychic real estate. And with Lucifer's abdication as ruler, it becomes the hottest piece of real estate in existence. Does the closing down of hell result in a universalist paradise? Where a world wherein no one is condemned to hell and there is universalist salvation? Alas, no. Hell's creator, you know who, decides that heaven needs a mirror, an equivalent. Hell is heaven's reflection. It is heaven's shadow. They define each other, reward and punishment, hope and despair. Two angels are assigned by the creator to oversee hell. While the angels first see their change in assignment as a punishment, they eventually decide that hell is necessary, and that while there will be punishment in hell, it will be the redemptive kind. As for Lucifer, well, you just might find him on the beaches of Perth, Australia, enjoying the creator's sunsets. He may not talk to the creator, but he does like his handiwork. Now, you may be asking yourself what Neil Gaiman has to do with Unitarian Universalism. Well, I can tell you honestly that these two books helped me to embrace and better understand Unitarian Universalism. Think of human nature. We see humans as capable of both great goodness and horrible evil. We don't write them off as one or the other. Instead, we recognize the complexity of the human soul. I personally believe that it is the wonder of free will that allows us to choose a particular action. Some of us think that there is an ineffability to the universe, and we respect the desires of those who follow different paths in an effort to lessen that ineffability. It is too great for us to speak of, to know entirely, but I think that some of us are okay with that. Then there is the idea of hell. The idea that hell is a place that you put yourself into, that it is psychic real estate that you condemn yourself to, makes sense to me. We, who are universalists, believe that even those souls who think themselves beyond saving will eventually see the literal light through the darkness. While Gaiman's writing may be seen as dark by some, I see something else. I see a thoughtfulness, a curiosity, a respect for the human condition. Some of his characters are distasteful, yes, but the same could be said of our own reality. There are also characters who, despite fate or the ineffable plan or the temptations of free will, do their best to make their reality better. That's exactly what can be said about our fellow humans, about us, and that is not fiction. Amen, and blessed be.